Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Friday, the 14th of June, these are our main stories. G7 leaders agree a $50 billion loan to Ukraine using profits from seized Russian assets. The US Supreme Court rejects an attempt to restrict access to a widely used abortion drug. And we hear how Hajj pilgrims travelling to Mecca are getting scammed by fake companies. Also in this podcast...
A tentative step out of a shipping crate, a mare named Tessa, the first of her kind to set foot in Kazakhstan for two centuries.
Conservationists are returning endangered wild horses to the Golden Steppe of Kazakhstan, and the postman who created a surprise football anthem. Let's begin with the war in Ukraine and specifically Western efforts to help the country defend itself against Russia. President Volodymyr Zelensky has proven very effective asking the most powerful leaders in the world for support and getting it. At the G7 meeting of seven of the world's richest nations in Italy, he's done that again. They agreed a $50 billion loan plan using the interest made by frozen Russian assets. He also signed a 10-year security agreement with President Biden.
Today is a truly historic day, and we have signed the strongest agreement between Ukraine and the US since our independence.
President Zelensky, this was President Biden speaking at the same news conference.
A lasting peace for Ukraine must be underwritten by Ukraine's own ability to defend itself now and to deter future aggression anytime in the future.
Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale has been telling me exactly what's been agreed.
The G7 leaders have agreed politically that it's right for them to use all those Russian assets that were frozen after the invasion of Ukraine back in 2022 to try and raise money for Ukraine. It's a lot of money. It's about $300 billion, and it's sitting in various pots, mostly in Belgium, mostly in the European Union. It's earning about $3 billion a year in interest. It's just sort of sitting there. And essentially, the leaders said, look, we should use that money. Now, they could just spend it, just sort of give it to Ukraine. But they thought that $3 billion a year for Ukraine won't actually touch the sides. So what they're going to do is they're going to try and raise a loan on the international money markets and use the $3 billion they get each year to pay off that loan. It's a bit like an interest-only mortgage. Now, the problem is that that sounds quite reasonable. Actually, there's a lot of detail still to be worked out, such as who precisely will raise the loan and when, and who will share the debt and the risk when it comes into fruition. So it's a political agreement. The details have still got to be worked out.
Let's talk about the choreography. President Zelensky, President Biden standing alongside each other, surrounded by US and Ukrainian flags, has obvious benefits for Ukraine. I suspect some benefits for Joe Biden as well at home through the prism of the US election.
Look, almost all of these leaders at the G7 are facing electoral challenges. Probably only the host, Giorgia Meloni, the Italian Prime Minister, is actually at the moment, you know, coming out of electoral success in the European Parliament. So I think there's a sense of just saying, look, you know, we're expecting there's going to be change. So let's make some changes now that are going to last longer than some of those elections. Whether it helps at home, that's a more moot point.
And also, could it be unpicked, you know, if you end up with Donald Trump in the White House, say, or some of the other faces around the G7 table changing? Could what's been agreed today be undone?
Well, they hope it won't. What they're trying to do is to lock it in so that it's sort of Trump-proof, if you like, to use that phrase that some analysts here have been using. Essentially say, look, get the money to Ukraine as quickly as possible. Do this deal before the Americans start coming up against the blocks of their election. I think the difficulty they've got now is a lot of those details now about how much Europe should bear the risk, how much the United States should bear the risk, That's the risk, is that gets caught up in the electoral process in the United States and the cash doesn't end up getting to Ukraine. It needs to get there fast, and there's still quite a lot of detail to be worked out.
Volodymyr Zelensky is an absolute expert at these negotiations, and what he always does is goes, thank you very much indeed for the $50 billion, and now I'd like something else. What's the something else this time?
Shells, 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 air defences, air defences, air defences. That's what he needs right now. In a news conference he gave with President Biden, he said, you know, we need 7 Patriot anti-aircraft missile systems. We simply don't have enough. A huge amount of Ukraine's energy infrastructure has been destroyed in the recent attacks by Russia. People in Ukraine are having to live with quite a few power outages at the moment. So that's what he needs, and he needs it fast. And you know, it's all well and good to have money to help with reconstruction and things like that. But what he actually needs right now is, as he always says, shells and air defences. Some are beginning to get to him, but it's still taking longer than he would want.
Our diplomatic correspondent, James Landau, with me from southern Italy. In a victory for abortion rights activists, US Supreme Court justices have unanimously upheld the right to use a widely available abortion pill. It's one of 2 drugs commonly used for terminating pregnancies in the US. A group of anti-abortion organisations had brought the case in an attempt to unravel the Food and Drug Administration's approval of this drug. Michelle Hendrickson from Students for Life of America was outside the court. She said they'd try again to push for a ban.
This is absolutely not the end of the road. We do believe that we'll be back in the court. There are, women all over the country with standing who can come forward now. This is just that first step. The door has been opened to have this conversation. More cases are going to come up and we'll be back.
Abortion rights groups have welcomed the decision, but warn there are many other attempts to limit abortion access in the US. Jacqueline Ayres from Planned Parenthood says the fight isn't over.
Abortion is on the ballot. The presidential race in the United States this year will absolutely be a debate over whether or not a candidate supports people's ability to make their personal decisions and respect bodily autonomy.
President Biden welcomed the decision, but said it didn't change the fact that women lost a fundamental freedom when the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade 2 years ago. Our North America correspondent Nomia Iqbal told me more about this latest ruling.
Well, this was a challenge to the drug mifepristone, and it's used in a majority of abortions in combination with another drug. The FDA made it more accessible in 2016 and 2021, such as you can take it later in pregnancy. Most women who have abortions take it up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. It also allows more health workers to prescribe it and to receive it in the post. So you have this group of anti-abortion doctors and anti-abortion organisations who do not believe that the drug should have federal approval. Now, it's really important to state the Supreme Court's unanimous decision, all 9 justices, they weren't taking a position on its safety or morality. Instead, the court basically said that the challengers had no legal standing to bring the case because whilst they may have moral, legal and ideological objections, they have not suffered direct and concrete injuries in order to sue because none of them use it, none of them prescribe it. And Justice Kavanaugh, one of the conservative justices, quoted the standing doctrine, this legal standing doctrine, which was succinctly summarised by Justice Scalia, who died in 2016, which basically requires plaintiffs to answer the question, what is it to you? And the plaintiffs in this case didn't really have any good answer to that question. And so it's important to state this isn't the justices suddenly deciding that mifepristone is fine to use or anything like that. They're just saying that it doesn't have the legal standing, so they can't look at the merits of the case. Nor does the ruling change the fact that medication abortion is still illegal in the 14 states with near total bans on abortion. And that's whether it's done by a procedure or a pill.
I was in Washington covering a US election 20 years ago, and I couldn't believe the extent to which this issue of abortion is part of the daily political discourse in the US. It still is now, obviously. Why?
It still is, and it has been for decades. It's important to say that anti-abortion activists have been for decades trying to make abortion illegal. When Roe v. Wade was introduced in the 70s, since then it never really had any peace. There was always attempts to whittle away at the constitutional right, and Ever since Roe v. Wade was overturned 2 years ago, it has become such a potent issue. And this, I would say, this ruling has allowed Republicans to dodge a potentially toxic issue in the midst of a tight presidential race. Democrats have seen that, publicly, most people still believe in the constitutional right to an abortion, and the majority of Americans still support access to medicated abortion. So it's still very much an issue as we head into the November presidential election.
Nomi Akbar with me from Washington. Russian prosecutors say the American journalist Evan Gershkovich will go on trial for espionage. No date has been given. Mr. Gershkovich was reporting for the Wall Street Journal last year when he was arrested. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg has more.
Evan Gershkovich has been in pre-trial detention in Moscow for more than 14 months. Now prosecutors have announced that his case will go to trial 1,000 miles away in Yekaterinburg, where he was arrested. They claim that the US journalist was working for the CIA and collecting information about a Russian tank factory. Mr. Gershkovich, his employer, and the US government fiercely reject the charge. The Wall Street Journal has previously accused Moscow of stockpiling Americans in Russian jails so as to trade them at a later date. And Russian officials barely hide the fact that they see Evan Gershkovich as a bargaining chip. Referring to efforts by the White House to secure Mr. Gershkovich's release, last week President Putin said that such questions require dialogue between intelligence agencies and should be resolved only on the basis of reciprocity. In other words, Russia wants someone in return. And that someone is thought to be FSB Security Service officer Vadim Krasikov, who's serving a life sentence for murder in Germany.
Every year, huge numbers of Muslims from around the world gather in Mecca in Saudi Arabia to perform the Hajj ritual. Many pilgrims choose to travel with tour companies, but the number of people getting scammed is causing increasing concern for the Saudi authorities, with many people being targeted by false social media ads or being given fake permits. For more on this, Ella Bicknell's been talking to Ethar Shalabi from BBC Arabic.
The Hajj is a pilgrimage all Muslims are expected to make once in their lifetime, if they are able. As the fifth pillar of Islam, it's a rite of passage. However, an increasing number of pilgrims are experiencing their worst nightmare, being refused entry to holy sites for unknowingly buying a fake permit.
It does cost a lot of money, and many people would be saving for years and years to be able to avoid a journey as such.
Ethar Shalabi is a senior journalist from the BBC's Arabic service. She says the most common scams are advertised on social media.
So people can easily fall trap of the last minute Hajj package with very attractive prices through tour operators online whom they haven't really verified. Some people fall in the trap of Google reviews, and most reviews are actually fake. One of the people I've spoken with told me that he knows of companies who would be paying people loads of money to be writing fake reviews online.
Another man Ethar interviewed spent $2,000 on his permit. It wasn't until he arrived in Mecca that authorities told him the barcode was forged.
When I was speaking with him over the phone, the guy was almost crying. He kept telling me, I lost my Hajj and my money as well. I lost both, and I am in Mecca. Like, Kaaba is just a few meters away from me, and I can't perform Hajj. And he was wearing the Hajj clothes and everything. So bless him, he was really in a heartbroken kind of state.
So far, he's had no response from the company which sold him the permit.
He's not received any emails or any responses, and even the representative was not responding to any of his calls. So he's staying now in a kind of a limbo, not being able to perform Hajj while he's actually in Mecca, and have lost already around $2,000.
Ethar told me that in recent years, the Saudi authorities have introduced new rules to regulate permits.
If you are in Europe, the Americas, or in Australia, you have to go through the Nusuk platform, and that is an official Saudi platform to be able to receive their Hajj permits. If you are in any other Arab country or Muslim country, you have to go through the official Hajj bureaus in your country, in the government, that basically liaise with the government, with the Saudi authorities. Do not ever rely on online reviews, social media advertisements, simply anyone who is not through an official entity.
It's estimated more than 1.8 million people will be making their way to Mecca from Friday for the start of the Hajj period, 90% of them coming from abroad. The Saudi ministry responsible for the Hajj told the BBC that its new SAC platform has significantly reduced cases of fraud. That will be good news for many. And that's because the Hajj pilgrimage remains a spiritual highlight for Muslims and often has a profound and positive effect on their lives.
Now, we've already reported on this podcast on how climate change is creating more favourable conditions for the invasive Asian tiger mosquito to spread into new environments and new countries, bringing with it a range of diseases. Now, the World Health Organization says the number of mosquito-borne dengue fever cases so far this year has already overtaken those for the whole of last year, with Brazil the worst affected country. So far, there have been 8 million cases globally. Our health correspondent Dominic Hughes was at the WHO briefing.
The spread really seems to have taken off. In December of last year, the World Health Organization issued what they basically said was an emergency call to action, given a rise in cases. But the cases so far this year, more than 7.5, in fact, nearly 8 million cases so far this year, have already outstripped the entire total for last year. And they warn that the true figure could be even higher, closer to 9 million. Now, so far, there have been around 4,000 deaths, and most of them have been in Central and South America. But, of course, that's where most of the season, if you like, for dengue fever, for the mosquito that carries the dengue fever, has been this year. We haven't really seen it spread to the northern hemispheres, where we're just starting to get into summer.
OK, and why is this happening this time particularly?
Well, it's a very complex picture, we're told. Part of it is being driven by climate change. As the oceans warm, that helps the mosquitoes spread, and they're spreading further north and further south. So the disease is spread by mosquitoes, which bite people during the day. So it's not a nighttime thing, it's a daytime thing. But those mosquitoes are spreading, and then not just north and south, but they're also spreading higher up. So they're being found at altitudes where cases have never been discovered before. So they talk about the mosquitoes as the vector of disease transmission. And they say it's affecting 150 countries. A lot of countries aren't really aware it's spreading into places like Europe increasingly. But the other big factor is weakened health systems after the COVID pandemic. That has triggered a lot of movement of people, but also a lot of weakened health systems still struggling with the after effects of that tremendous pandemic.
Now, obviously, you can't treat dengue fever. That's the big problem. So what can you do to curb it?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of vaccines that are available, but they're used in really, honestly, very limited circumstances. The main way of treating it is prevention. So preventing the mosquitoes from being able to breed. So that means, for example, getting rid of areas of stagnant water in which the mosquitoes breed. So, and also making sure that areas, for example, that have lots of rubbish in are cleared away. So rubbish on the street, stagnant water around homes, in gardens, that sort of thing. So it's really trying to both prevent the mosquitoes from breeding in the first place that spread this disease, but then also educating people themselves about the risk of dengue and measures they can take, for example, wearing long sleeve tops, for example, during the day, so that their arms aren't exposed to be bitten by the mosquitoes.
Our health correspondent, Dominic Hughes. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
It's crazy. I'm getting hundreds of friend requests. I'm getting messages asking for FaceTime messages to their uncles and kids. Newspapers are talking about it. It's just blown up over there.
The Scottish postman who's created a surprise global football hit ahead of the Euros. Shareholders at the electric car company Tesla have voted to approve a pay package of $56 billion for its chief executive Elon Musk, believed to be the biggest in US corporate history. The decision was announced at a vote at Tesla's headquarters in Texas. Our North America business correspondent Erin Delmore has been explaining to Oliver Conway the case for Mr. Musk getting so much.
He deserves the sum, and that's because he's taken the company to such heights since this pay deal was initially ratified by the board and by shareholders back in 2018. Now, the case against him has been that he's spread thin, and certainly he's had some controversial leadership over the last few months and years. Now, This is essentially a vote of confidence in Mr. Musk's leadership and the future of the firm. To put it very simply, the people who voted for this pay package think that Tesla just can't operate without him.
Yeah, a public relations win for Elon Musk, but this will still have to go back to court if he's to secure this pay package. What could happen there?
Right. It's not quite so simple as shareholders vote in favor and the pay package gets instated. No, this is likely to be tied back up in the courts because, remember, a Delaware judge struck this down. He said that it was not going to be going into effect. Now, the board is hoping that by showing the shareholder approval, they can use it as proof positive that this is something that investors want to see happen and want Musk to be awarded. But it will have to go through the courts and could even see fresh new legal challenges.
Now, some of the big investors weren't happy about this. They said they were going to vote against. They called the pay deal ridiculous and excessive. But the so-called retail or ordinary investors backed it in huge numbers. Why does Elon Musk inspire such devotion?
This is one of the quirks of this story here, and it's because Tesla has more retail investors, individual investors, than a lot of companies do. Just a greater share of them make up Tesla's ownership. That and the support we see today speaks to Mr. Musk's cult of personality. They are flocking to Tesla because they are following him and perhaps also following his endeavors at the other companies that he owns. That support ended up being crucial. And not only did those retail investors and many of the institutional investors also vote for this pay package, they came out to vote at all. That was looking to be the challenge in the past couple of weeks, turning out voters, especially these individuals who own small amounts of shares in Tesla. So this is essentially a large win for Tesla's chief executive, and it makes him the most generously awarded CEO in U.S. corporate history.
Our North America business correspondent, Erin Delmore. The UN Security Council has voted to demand an end to the siege of El Fasher in Sudan's Darfur region by the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. 14 countries backed the resolution, with Russia abstaining. El Fasher is the only city in Darfur that remains under army control amidst a civil war that's lasted more than a year. Neda Torfik has more.
Ambassador Barbara Woodward said the UK put forward the resolution to help secure a localized ceasefire around El Fasher to create wider conditions to support de-escalation across the country and ultimately to save lives. The threat of a large-scale massacre looms large, the U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield warned, and already villages have been razed to the ground and hospitals bombed and looted. The text calls for the withdrawal of all fighters that threaten civilians and for those civilians to be allowed to leave to safer areas. To overcome persistent aid access obstructions that have pushed people to the brink of famine, the Council also wants the parties to allow and facilitate the delivery of humanitarian assistance, with a specific call for Sudanese authorities to reopen the Adre border crossing. Sierra Leone's Ambassador Amara Sheikh Mohamed Sawa, speaking on behalf of the African members of the Council, denounced foreign interference, saying the Sudanese people don't need more arms, they need peace. The resolution calls on member states to comply with the Darfur arms embargo.
The war in Sudan has killed thousands and forced millions from their homes. And that conflict is one of the contributing factors behind a staggering new statistic. A total of 120 million people around the world who've been forcibly displaced by war, violence and persecution. That figure, which is the equivalent of the population of Japan, has risen for the 12th year in a row, according to the UN Refugee Agency. Kelly Clements, the body's Deputy High Commissioner, explained why so many people have been displaced.
It is a combination of factors. We have some long-standing crises and conflicts with no political solution, and people continued to be either internally displaced in their own countries, or most of them have gone to neighboring countries to wait for peace to return to their home communities so that they too can return. And these are places like Afghanistan, Syria, now Ukraine, Venezuela, and Myanmar. And then on top of that, and particularly in the last year, you have fresh misery. And I think the best example of that, there are two. One, of course, is in Gaza, and the other, in terms of misery, is the Sudan situation. And in Sudan, we're talking about nearly 11 million people, most internally displaced and displaced multiple times. But you also have refugees that have gone to South Sudan, to Chad, to Ethiopia, and other neighboring countries. And these are countries that have already been hosting Sudanese refugees from crises and wars in the past. So it's a combination of factors in terms of new crises and those protracted situations that have no political solution.
The UNHCR's Kelly Clements there. Now to Kazakhstan, where wild horses have returned to their ancestral lands for the first time in 200 years after decades of planning by conservationists. A small herd taken from zoos around Europe is being gradually reintroduced into the grass and wetland there. Here's Stephanie Prentice.
A tentative step out of a shipping crate, followed by a canter across the grassland. A mare named Tessa, the first of her kind to set foot in Kazakhstan for two centuries. Some of her stablemates weren't so easy. But a team of conservationists from Prague Zoo were determined to reintroduce Przewalski's horses, seen as the last of the world's truly wild horses, to their original habitat. They ferried one stallion and six mares in army planes across Europe via Istanbul and Azerbaijan. Miroslav Bobek is the director of the operation.
These are the first wild horses which have touched soil in the steppes of central Kazakhstan in hundreds of years. We managed to get these horses here from Prague alive and healthy. And of course, more will follow. These are just the first step.
The sandy brown horses with thick, dark manes and tails once roamed across Central Asia. Artifacts show people were riding them and using them for food for at least 2,000 years before records of any domestic horses in Europe. Biodiversity specialist Albert Salamgayarev says bringing the horses back will also help restore the ecosystem of the steppe by spreading seeds.
For scientists, yeah, it's also quite important to have these wild horses in the central Kazakhstan. The wild horses serve another important role, especially for the steppe, to distribute non-native or not common plants.
It's a role they have some time to adapt to. The group will stay in a 60-hectare pen for around a year before facing the more brutal weather conditions on the wider plains. The horses have already been reintroduced in China and Mongolia, where the population now numbers more than 800. Prague Zoo says it wants to play the role of a modern Noah's Ark, making sure endangered species can survive before putting them back where they belong.
Now, if you're a football fan, the wait is almost over because the Euros are almost upon us. Millions of soccer fans around the world will follow the tournament in Germany, either by going there or from home, maybe wearing the shirt of your favourite team. And those outfits are big business, but prices have been rocketing. This dad says he can't afford to buy his children the officially licensed kits.
I can get basically shirts for all four of my children for the cost of one shirt, legitimately. There are children who are demanding, and parents are under a lot of pressure. I'm fortunate to be in a position where I can even afford the copies. I know there are people now who, unfortunately, are probably struggling even to buy those because money is so tight.
The rise in prices has led to a huge increase in counterfeit shirts, but consumer groups have warned fans about buying from potentially dodgy sites. Leanna Byrne has been talking to our business reporter, Pierre-Antoine Denis.
Let's say that if you want to go the official route, that will set you back about $108 for the official replica kit.
Wow.
It kind of shocks some buyers who just went out there looking for other options. The popularity of this websites that are selling really, really good replica are basically on the rise. Globally, the damage for Nike is estimated to be around $3.6 billion as part of this counterfeits website.
That is a lot of money to lose. But at the same time, I understand why people might want to go towards the fake shirts route, because it is a lot cheaper. But the thing is, if you show up at the Euros with a fake shirt, that could be a bit of an issue for you, couldn't it?
And the German authorities are very strict on this. The Germans are hosting the Euros. They can fine people carrying these counterfeit items up to around $6,000. And also, of course, another important point here, these websites may not be entirely secure. So giving away your bank details, your identity, your address to these platforms may actually cost you much more than your actual Nike shirt in the official shop.
Staying with football, a postman from Scotland has created an unofficial anthem for his nation's Euros team, which has become a surprise success among football fans far away from home.
Tales of fit, but I've been told of triumph and dismay.
Nick Morgan's No Scotland, No Party has struck a chord in Argentina. Its tune comes from a popular song about Diego Maradona called The Hand of God, which celebrates his controversial goal against England in the 1986 World Cup. Nick says he's astonished at how it's been received there.
It's crazy. I'm getting hundreds of friend requests. I'm getting messages asking for FaceTime messages to their uncles and kids. Newspapers are talking about it. I'm doing radio interviews and up with sports channels. It's just blown up over there.
And his now viral hit has also been adopted much closer to home.
It's just trending on TikTok. I've been sent videos of random people travelling to Germany, singing it in the car, singing it in pubs. Yeah, it just seems like everyone seems to know it. It's surreal.
Nick Morgan is taking his guitar to the tournament to meet up with the Tartan Army and will be in Dusseldorf when Scotland play the host Germany in the opening match. Nick Morgan's No Scotland, No Party. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition, drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Or on X, we are @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Chris Cazares. The producer was Stephanie Sacristan. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.